Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening from Fort Lauderdale. This is Nate Klarfeld with Stonewall Live, the best of gay and lesbian book, film, and media talk on Blog Talk Radio. Tonight, my guest is Thomas Mornian. We even practiced that one. An author who's written a wonderful book called Hidden about GLBT runaway youth. It's based on a news article he wrote for the San Francisco Bay Guardian called Hiding Out. And let me just say hello. Hello, Thomas.
Hi, how are you? Hi, everybody in the blogosphere.
In the blogosphere?
Yeah.
Let me read a little bit. Let me set the stage of the book, and then we'll start talking, okay? Because not every listener has bought and read the book yet. This is not a book club. When 15-year-old Ahmed inadvertently outs himself to his parents, they take him to a residential treatment center in the Nevada desert, Serenity Ridge, where he is tortured, molested, and put through a straight rehabilitation program. After 11 months, Ahmed manages to escape to a safe house for runaway gay teens in San Francisco, where he meets a slew of other kids like himself, all with their own stories to tell, most just as traumatizing as his own or worse. But inside the safe house, it is never entirely safe. Thomas, how much of this is autobiographical?
Of the book?
Of the book, yes.
I was a gay teenager.
Check one.
So that part is. And then, you know, other parts of it are definitely autobiographical. It's such a complicated thing when you write a book. I mean, you're taking from your life and other people's lives and things you've seen, things you've heard, all of that. So it's kind of like to pinpoint, like, one thing. I would say the one thing would be I came out really young. A friend of mine, Dee Dee Scheidler, said when I finished high school barely, she was like, Tom Mornian's closet is everyone else's living room. And I always thought that was kind of true because, like, fifth grade on, I was, you know, wearing, you know, my little outfits. Uh-huh. And it was kind of, I didn't really ever come out. It was always kind of assumed. And I was really tormented by it. So, you know, my parents really struggled with it. And, you know, some not great things happened as a result of that. And, you know, so that part is definitely, I'm not Arab. I'm not, you know, Muslim or any of that. But the other part, the feelings underneath are definitely me.
Let's go back to that Arab and Muslim. You chose to make your lead character from a minority group, a very strict religious group, stricter than many or most. Why did you choose a Muslim family?
Well, a couple reasons. I had met this guy, Patrick, who was from Lebanon, while I was working on the book, and he was a teenager, and he was really intrigued by the idea of my book, and he said, you should make your character, you know, Muslim. And I was like, okay, why? And he described the, you know, the things that go on in the Middle East to a lot of queer people. And that really sort of dovetailed with my interest in what was going on in, like, Guantanamo Bay and how we have, I think in this country, you know, demonized people because of the color of their skin or their religious beliefs. There were also a lot of parallels between what happened in Serenity Ridge and another story that I reported on, this place in Jamaica called Tranquility Bay. You know, very parallel, the extra rendition, you know, the people being taken out of their bed in the middle of the night, flown to this marshalling point, sent out of the country. And there were all these parallels between the novel that I was writing and what was going on in, like, 2006, 2005, 2007, stuff that Janet Malcolm wrote about in The New Yorker. She wrote about them, but the Black Ops place, all of that stuff. So it all sort of came together, and you know, I live in Los Angeles, that's the other thing, and when I was at an artist colony in Saratoga Springs, Yaddo, I was really struck by how white it was. And I live in a place where I see all sorts of people all the time, and I wanted to write something that was really pan-ethnic, that was like, you know, The Fast and the Furious, but for queer teens. So once Patrick said that, to bring it back to the beginning, I just made that choice and went with it. I think a lot of racial profiling goes on in Los Angeles towards Latino people, so you know, it wasn't something that I was unfamiliar with, and I see a lot of parallels between that and what's going on with the Arab community and our government.
Right. Yeah, I really, really loved it when I started reading it, and I realized it was Ahmed, because I read a lot of young adult gay novels, I read a lot of regular gay novels, and they are, for a long, long time, for 20 or 30 years, the GLBT literature was the coming out story, the white college graduate sitting with an empty typewriter, and there's a gay pride parade outside, and he's starting to write his life story. The same story over and over and over again. Only in the last, I think, 5 years have people like you brought wonderful, wonderful energy into gay and lesbian literature, and you added another piece of fabric, like another layer of fabric, because you realize you've got somebody here who's got like a double, triple minority or something. I mean, he's young, he's not of age yet, he's gay, he's a Muslim, he's confused. I mean, there's so many layers, so that this is not though you do laugh when you read the book, because some of the things that, I mean, come on, it's pretty funny. I'm not, you know, the stuff on the, you know, with all the nicknames and his descriptions of people and people describing him are really pretty funny, but it's a pretty sad story. I'm going to talk a little bit about what's going on in the country about these rehabilitation centers or residential treatment centers. I don't know if most people realize this, but most of them are faith-based, and in many states, faith-based youth teen camps are not even inspected or regulated. What goes on there is it the same in California? I know it's the same in Florida and where I came from in the Midwest.
I'm not doing journalism right now, so I'm not really up on what's going on out there, but it does seem, if Michelle Bachmann's husband is any indication, they're not just not being inspected, they're also being funded by the federal government, you know.
Correct.
Which is a clear violation of church and state. And I think there was a famous documentary that came out for kids in elementary school about gay parents or gay kids, I forget what it was, and the religious right kind of gave up on, you know, the whole children thing, but it seems as though it's been this persistent thing against teenagers because they're so liminal. They're in between, and a lot of teenagers are hard to deal with, so you have the teenageness and then the sexuality asserting itself or the sexual identity, and I think also teenagers are coming out a lot earlier. They're just not willing to wait until they're 18.
Exactly.
And you know, all of that. So it becomes this, you know, I think very volatile brew. And living in California or Florida or New York, you know, that religious thing isn't as predominant in my culture. There's like, there's religion and stuff. There's like a mosque up the street and like a synagogue and all that. But it's not something that defines my life. Whereas I think in the middle of the country, those religious beliefs really define communities. And so kids, particularly in like Idaho, I met this guy a few years ago, like 2 years ago, and he was like, oh yeah, that stuff is still going on.
Right.
And how kids are navigating it, though, I think they're becoming smarter. And that was one of the things I wanted to get across in the book was, you know, this is the worst case scenario. Coming out when you're 16 isn't for everyone because you don't have any legal rights. And that was something that when it happened to me, I wasn't really aware. I was like, oh yeah, I need to come out. And a lot of people encouraged me to come out as a queer teenager. But I had really no legal rights. My parent, you're like a slave. You know, your parents, unless you get emancipated and all of that, which is, you know, that's its own cumbersome process. But even then, there's that in-between period where, you know, horrible things can happen. So I think rather than this, you know, monolithic sort of, you know, saying everybody should come out, you know, it's very, I think, specific to each individual. And I'm not attacking religions. I'm just saying, you know, maybe a kid, if they are queer identified, you know, could, you know, not curtail themselves, but be smart about coming out, you know, so they don't go on with their life with all these horrible things having happened to them.
Right. You know, the Dan Savage It Gets Better campaign, you know, I listen to Dan on his podcast, and he talks about, you know, leaving your home when you're 18, you know, waiting till you're 18, come out, but stay quiet. And then I was reading your part of your book, and I underlined it and folded it down to make sure I'd mention it tonight. obviously these kids are very poor. I mean, they leave the house with the clothes on their back. They go to the they run away from these residential treatment centers, which cost tens of thousands of dollars a week or a month or whatever. $20,000 to $30,000 for a stay. They run away from these things with absolutely no money. And one of the safe houses, there's a conversation. I guess it's Sugar. I wrote myself a name. Sugar Kid Hammer. I love your nickname. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay.
Anyway, and the line is, the only difference between 15 and 18 is welfare.
Yeah.
That just hit me because, yeah, where do these kids go at 18? You can get a job. You don't have a high school diploma. You have no skills. You're pretty jaded into the world. I mean, it's, you know, being on your own at, you know, 14, 15, 16. So where do you go? How do you make a life for yourself? Have you talked to any of these kids that have made it pretty well?
Well, I mean, I was one of those kids. So, you know, but I think things have changed economically in this country in the last, you know, 10, 15, 20 years so dramatically that, you know, moving to, you know, the Castro or Los Angeles or New York is no longer something that you just kind of do. You know,
right.
If you do that and you're a teenager, you're probably going to end up doing sex work or, you know, something, it's going to be a real, I mean, some sort of struggle is going to happen,
right.
That's going to be really hard. And I think it's hard enough to move to a city as a professional. But that was something that I was also wanting to get across, was how the economics of things have impacted, I think,
right.
Your youth in a way that, like, adults aren't necessarily, you know, aware of, that there's, like, this economic dividing line. You know, what was
right.
possible 20 years ago isn't
right.
necessarily possible now. And it's not, and people... You know, people start out in a certain way, and they tend to follow that path. I think once you get into
right.
that, it's really hard to get out of it. And queer teens being much more vulnerable to this, you know, to being kicked out or, you know, economically disenfranchised, not getting an education. I mean, it's
right.
so hard to get in college as it is. You know, I think that there are more, probably a lot more homeless queer youth than our community is really sees or knows or is able to acknowledge. I mean, we're very married to these media images of, you know,
right.
successful gay people, and that's great. But not everyone, you know, works at McCann Erickson or, you know, AT&T
right.
or, you know, is a constituent of GLAAD or, you know, the Human Rights Campaign. A lot of people are not, that's not their reality, you know.
Right.
And I think that was something that I was trying to get across too, is there are a lot of people in our community who are in front of us, around us. I see them in my city where I live in Los Angeles, and they're just not, you know, they're not enfranchised, you know, or they're working
right.
like really, you know, bare minimum wage jobs without, you know, blah, 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 all of that. So
right.
That was something that I wanted to get across.
You did, in that one sentence. I mean, in that one sentence, an offhand remark, you know, the
yeah.
only difference between 15 and 18 is welfare. And I did realize that, and you're absolutely right. I'm a lot older than I sound. I'm 61 years old.
Wow.
And I know, it's amazing. My birthday's Saturday, it's 61 is Saturday. And I'm just going to give you just, and don't feel bad or anything like that. I did leave home early and did some of the same things, but in the 1960s, I know I'm sounding like your parents.
no, you're not. I wanted to say I'm a Virgo too. My birthday is September 11th. So,
oh,
yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, I have a very organized life. But anyway, I did move away, applied to college, got in, worked my way as a waiter, and had an apartment for $200 a month in Manhattan.
Right. But could you do that now?
No, there's no way you could pay for school and live, and, you know, but you could, you know, up till a very short period of time ago, until about the beginning of the Reagan administration, you could work your way through something, you know, roommating, you know, living in a room, something like that. You cannot anymore. And the schools have gotten outrageous. Housing, transportation is ridiculous. I mean, you live in Los Angeles, you know what I mean? These kids don't have cars. There's your number one thing. How do you get an education without a car? How do you get a job without a car? And of course, a lot of your book details, sometimes humorous, sometimes scary, ways that these young kids get around. You know, it's a very scary way of getting around.
Yeah, It is.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you get in your car, you get in your subway, you've got your tokens, you've got your money, you have a certain sort of a. What I was feeling when I read Hidden was, I kept thinking safety net. These kids, these people, because I started thinking of as people, have no safety net. You know, you have a family you could always go home to. I felt that when Ahmed left, he was jumping off a cliff. He was jumping out of an airplane. It was over. He would never run with his tail between his legs back home. You know, it just wasn't going to happen.
Right, and I think that's there. You know, I ended I ended the novel on a fairly ambiguous note because I wanted him to. I'd written an epilogue at one point, and then I was like, you know what, that doesn't really work for me. So I ended it the way I ended it because I feel like, you know, as difficult of an experience that he's been through, and I think his issue isn't so much like how to get around, but that he can't get around, that he's trapped mm-hmm. inside and, you know, going through this sort of Anne Frank existence of,
right.
you know, is he going to be caught, is he not going to be caught? And that's its own form of oppressiveness, not being
right.
able to move. But I think that once he does step outside of the safe house and he leaves and he, you know, goes in search of, you know, the boy that he's met in the safe house, you know, there was something affirmative in that because it was like I couldn't tell the rest of his story. You know, maybe I will in a subsequent book, but the idea that he felt, you know, strengthened enough by this experience and confident enough that he was going to go out into the world and, you know, it's that old, you know, Cannard, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And I really
right.
feel like he and the other kids, you know, were examples of that. And that's sort of the idealistic, Pollyannish, hopeful quality.
Right.
So, yeah.
I'm so glad you wrote a hot romance into this. Or a long... No,
That was the other thing was like, you know, as bad as things get, people still fall in love. They still have sex. They still, you know,
right.
go through heartbreak and, you know, hopefulness and all of that. And that was the other thing was like, okay, well, you can do all these things to these kids, but kids are so resilient, you know. And
right.
in the book, it was like, and those relationships are so, you know, complex. That was the other thing was like, I think a lot of teenagers, you know, yes, there are gay straight alliances and stuff and all of that, but it's still so heterosexually oriented in high school.
Right. Oh my
teens,
God.
Yeah. Teens don't really queer teens don't really get to date. So I wanted to write something that, you know, was both about like an important social issue, but then also had this, you know, real human element of like falling in love. Like, why can't two 16-year-olds fall in love? And I think that, you know, the thing about teen sexuality, queer teen sexuality specifically, that the religious right has used against the gay community, has really cowed the gay community, is like,
right.
oh, well, you're all pedophiles, or we're all pedophiles. And
right.
the reality is there's a lot of, like, same age dating going on between teenagers, you know, and that's
sure.
sort of like, okay, well, what does that do to your accusation? You know what I mean? Not
right.
your accusation, but, you know.
Anything, yeah.
Yeah, so I felt like that was really important to put forth, you know, not as an example. I mean, it was organic to the story, but I was really glad
right.
that was something I was able to write about.
I'm glad, too, because it not only does it shows they're human. It shows that it's not just a bunch of rats waiting to get out. You know, there's the human emotions. You want to know what's going on. It's a drive. It's a driving force in the novel, I think. It's really, really good. Okay, so how did these nicknames come about? I love the nicknames. So
okay, which one?
Hammer, Kid, Peanut. Anita Fix, we probably know. We need to talk about her first, okay?
Okay, Anita Fix.
Only because of Chaz Bono. Only because of Chaz Bono this week.
Anita Fix is actually, there's a sort of a genderqueer person in Los Angeles. His name is Frankie, and he was someone I met when I first got to LA, and he was a go-go dancer at this place called Club F delete 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 K. Or can you say profanity on the show?
You can say anything you want.
Okay, so it's called Club Fuck, and
okay.
So he was a dancer there, and he had diva tattooed on the back, and his he wasn't a drag queen, but he had like an ulterior like personality, and her name was Anita Fix, and I never
oh.
forgot that. And
oh
I was just
God.
Like, Anita Fix. As far as sugar goes, that's the name of one of my aunts. Yeah, right. I don't think she knows that. Hammer is, there's a guy named David who I know from, he was a student at CalArts at one point, and he was like this gay, I mean, he looks very much like Hammer, almost exactly like, he does, uh-huh. He is Hammer. He's like tall, got the, he has that sort of Aryan youth thing, and he was that idealized sort of gay person, and I don't know where the Hammer came from, I just thought like Hammerhead, it was like, how do you describe someone as looking like a, you know, an Aryan youth without
right.
calling them a Nazi? So I thought Hammer was kind of the closest. And then I think Tom DeLay was in my head probably too.
Oh.
And then JD, because he has such an ambiguous identity, that may or may not be his name. You know, he's
oh,
playing so much with his own identity. JD,
right.
you can assign whatever you want to it. Kid, you know, is sort of like the archetypal kid. You know,
right.
he's bratty, he's offensive, he's, you know, churlish, he's, you know, just obnoxious and, you know,
mm-hmm.
sexy and he's going to work it. And the other characters, Marcy was sort of a variation on a girl that I knew who ran the safe house. What were the other ones?
Oh, Peanut.
Peanuts was actually named after someone that I knew who lived in the safe house, and it was a fake name. So I felt, you know what, I'm not using anyone's real name because it's not
right.
real to begin with. And I just
right.
always liked Peanuts because, you know, I think in my head, although that person wasn't intersexed and I didn't really have the consciousness to write about intersexness, that Peanuts
uh-huh.
is intersexed and sort of, you know, a bag full of peanuts. You know, you don't
okay.
know what you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
And then
good.
There was like, there's another one, isn't there?
Oh, I don't know. I had a whole bunch of notes, and they're all over the floor and all over the wall. So we've talked about what? We've gone about like nine different areas here. Okay, hold on. Those are the funny ones. Those are the ones I remember.
Okay.
Those are the ones I remember without looking at my notes, which is where I can look at them anymore. Okay. So everybody has, you said fake names, not real names. Did you feel like when you were doing the research for Hiding Out, your original article, for the San Francisco Bay Guardian, did you feel like everybody was kind of like had a veneer?
A veneer in what sense?
Like hiding something. Like they had a real person underneath, but they really weren't all coming out to you. Like that's what I feel like. Everything in the book, everyone comes out in layers like an onion. You know, like at the beginning, nobody wants to talk. They're all kind of tough. They're all kind of, and then they slowly start getting funny, making little jokes, and then they start getting real serious. Did you find that to be true when you spoke to the runaway youths?
Well, the kids I got to know over a long period of time, and I think that there were they put a lot of trust in me, so they're pretty transparent with me. One of them actually lived with me, the girl who's modeled after Nadia / Alice. She had like five different names, and I could never keep them straight. But she was, so young, and it was like just, it didn't work out. It lasted for about a month. I was just not equipped to take care of a teenager.
Right.
But she was very emotional, and, you know, I found a lot of the kids looked older than they were, so they had sort of this self-possessed quality from having, you know, having to kind of pass as sort of quasi, you know, older teenagers when they may have been like, you know, 14, you know, and I think a 14-year-old is very emotional, pretty emotionally transparent, pretty confused, pretty just the. So they're very direct. I found that as they got older, one of them in particular, one of the boys, he had like a lot of legal problems and had, you know, gotten to a lot of drugs and stuff like that. And he was always really straight with me. Like he was always like, you know, this is what happened, da 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 da. I never quite trusted him, so I never knew what the story was. I eventually was able to figure it out. The thing is, I think with that story was I was reporting, I was kind of like taking a snapshot. You're looking at people
mm-hmm.
at a moment in their life. I don't know what they're like now because I'm not in touch with any of them, but I would imagine that they, you know, that they grew up and became, you know, I was just seeing like the sort of the seedlings, the larvae version of them,
right?
You know, and
mm-hmm.
then they would go on to do other things, you know, I
that
hope.
They could surprise you. They could surprise you. Okay, so tell us about your phone call from George Michael after the article came out. I'll
start
singing.
Okay, so well, what happened with George Michael was my article was published without my permission in a magazine in London called Attitude, and it's kind of like the out magazine of England. And So I was surprised to see my article in a magazine on the newsstand. Yeah, I was like, how did this happen? And it was syndicated with that. Yeah, that was a whole other story. But so the phone was ringing really early in the morning, and I was, hello, and I thought it was my friend Andrew because he lives in London, and he kept saying, no, this is George Michael, and they sound exactly the same. So I kept hanging up on him, and he kept calling back, and I'm like, why is he playing this prank on me? So finally he got me on the phone and was like about to perform at a Quality Rocks. There was like literally 2 weeks until he performed there. It was this concert at JFK years ago that had like, I forget, there was like some country singer and George and like various people who sang to raise money for, to raise awareness around gayness, I think. So 2 weeks, and he was like, I want to hire people to do this, and, can you put me in touch with all the people that I need to do this? And I was like, well, I think that would work, for, like, I'm a sex, some sexy video, but this is, like, I could, sure, go try it, but it's not going to work. So I basically said, I will do it. And then I have a friend who's a filmmaker, and we very quickly made plans, like drove up to San Francisco the next day and filmed those interviews, and then came down to LA and were editing until the last minute when the tape went to, John took it to Washington, and it was shown in the middle of George's four song set. And that was it. He was really nice to deal with. I mean, he was very supportive and encouraging. He totally underwrote everything. We got deals on a lot of things. We got a lot of support from the community. Jenny Livingston gave us a camera and stuff. She's up there in San Francisco, and so it was good. We were able to work something out that I think wasn't like extravagant, and he was really pleased with it. And I never found out why from his manager why he was so drawn to that subject, but he was very determined to make something about it. So if George wants to contact me, he can contact me and like dispel that mystery at this point.
All right. Well, maybe you should go study that and do another book and an article.
About George Michael? I think he's doing his own study on himself.
He's his own hot mess. So
yeah, his own Twitterness. He twitters constantly. Yeah,
I know. I'm on his Twitter feed, and it's like, enough. Turn it off.
Right?
Get another thumb. Well, we talked a little bit in our little 5-minute pre-talk. We sound like we're old friends, but we only met 5 minutes before the show. And tonight there's a CNN 2-part special on these treatment centers, teen runaway centers. Not necessarily gay and lesbian, though they intimated that it was a gay and lesbian. There was going to be a gay and lesbian segment one of the nights. And Cyndi Lauper, I think this week or last week, just opened up her. Her homeless shelter in New York City for GLBT youth. How many of those need to open before it makes a dent, even makes a dent in the problem?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, I'm not a sociologist, and I don't have access to those sorts of, figures. And how does one, quantify or qualify, forget what it is, but like people who are being abused because they're queer. I mean, you look at the kid who was killed up the coast in Ventura County. There, I don't know if they've handed in the verdict yet.
But it was a mistrial today.
It was a mistrial. Yeah, I mean,
just a few minutes ago.
And he obviously or seemed to my understanding trans, and another kid walks in and shoots him in the head, and they're calling it. They're saying that the kid who shot him in the head, it's gay panic defense, which is the oldest, most tiredest defense. And it's like, if that still has currency in 2011, I think as a community we're kidding ourselves that queer youth are any more protected or able to come out and not be, I mean, he was killed in a classroom.
Got a gun and brought the gun to school.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of like, and, think the suicides and stuff have always been going on. But it seems, I think the thing with the media is that there's this attention that's brought to this. I mean, Barbara Walters was doing stuff about this 20 years ago.
Right.
And then people get all up in arms, and then nothing happens. And I think it's one of the larger problems of the left, or,
We don't keep it. We don't keep it on the front burner.
We haven't, like, created institutions to really, pursued laws that would hold these facilities accountable for what they're doing. There has been a bill in the House that's been stalled for like 6 years, and it almost came to a vote, and then the Republican leadership took over, and it addresses some of this stuff. And it's like, where is HRC in this? Where is NCLR in this? Where are these big organizations? Yeah,
we're running out of time, Tom. Tom,
sure.
Tomas, I'm sorry.
Tomas, that's okay.
You've been absolutely fabulous. What's your last words?
My last words are, thank you, Nate, for having me on the show.
Okay, and thank you, and good night from Fort Lauderdale. Thanks, Tomas.
Okay, thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.